Hey everyone, welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, a program that covers literature, cultural criticism, films, and theory. I'm Patrick Barney, and with me are the two other regular hosts, Chris Moltisanti and Hans Gruber. Today we're discussing a classic of British literature, A Journal of the Plague Year, written by Daniel Defoe and published in 1722. Plague Year styles itself as the journal of one H.F., a saddler living in London during the outbreak of the bubonic plague in 1665. Along with non-fictional statistics gathered from the actual bills of mortality that reported weekly deaths during the plague, the novel includes fictional anecdotes of a variety of characters. One such is the story of a river trader who cares for his infected wife and children by buying and selling goods in non-infected towns along the Thames. Another is the story of two brothers who decide to escape London by forcing their way through outlying quarantine towns. In addition, the narrator, H.F., tells of his own life and troubles. So that's the novel in a nutshell. And I wrote one question down that I was going to start with, but Hans, you already kind of gave your answer to the question. So, you know, before we started, you made a wry comment about how this book was not interesting, and you know, so you wanna start with that, Hans? Tell us why you didn't find the book interesting.
I mean, I think it's I'm sure it's of historical interest or academic interest, right? I know that you know, you had pointed out, and I did a little bit of background reading on it after I finished, and it seems like compositionally the way that he is hybridizing what we would now think of as fiction and nonfiction techniques is interesting. It sounds like it was based on his grandfather's diaries of living during the plague. So it's interesting on that level as a historical record of, it seems like, even though Defoe didn't actually live through this, it seems from what I can, from a glance, like it's generally accepted that the account it gives is accurate, right? So I understand why you could argue that it's of either kind of academic interest, historical interest, why it might be, you know, from a scholarly standpoint, a valuable document. I just didn't think it was very interesting as a novel, you know? I mean, it doesn't really have characters in the classical sense. It doesn't really have a plot in any meaningful way, right? Like, events happen, but it's just kind of a disconnected string of anecdotes. You don't really get to know anybody as a character. You don't have any sense of character moments or decision-making. You don't have... it's somewhat repetitive, right? Like, similar events, similar analyses are given. It's not really particularly cunning at the level of language. So it is just very, even though like I'm glad it exists as a record, as an archive, I have to admit that I found it as a novel really pretty uncompelling. And it has this particular quality of both being, you know, very dull as a novel and also full of all sorts of unpleasant things. So it achieves a striking balance of unpleasant and boring that I just have to admit I was very, very glad when it was over. And I presume most of the show will be you explaining what's admirable and interesting about it, and I'm certainly ready to hear that, but I really didn't like it.
Chris, do you want to add your opinion, like what your experience was like as well?
Yeah, I mean, and just to say, he was alive for the plague. He was 5. But and I think that that's interesting for some of the reasons, kind of approaching from the other side, that Hans is referring to. Like the this is not a very, it doesn't feel intimately interesting, right? It doesn't commit to an arc of, you know, sort of personal relevancy of the plague. It's sort of is trying to position itself as very rationally sort of detailed. And I, you know, whether that's there for verisimilitude or, you know, for some other reason, it's just sort of a mystery what Daniel Defoe was exercising in himself writing this. It feels like it feels very proto, maybe proto nonfiction. You know, I if you look up the plague year, you'll come up with at least one book about the pandemic, right? So there's a nonfiction movement that is like very mature now, that has a bunch of forms that you can sort of integrate into what you're doing to give, you know, shape and some forward momentum and some stakes and some mystery and all of that. And it feels almost, and I don't know this to be true, that like this is kind of lacking that library of tools for a nonfictional, you know, creative nonfiction work. And I know that it's fiction, but it really does feel like, I don't know. Some of the interactions and some of the anecdotes we've talked about this before. Sometimes when a fictional text is hewing very close to nonfictional, or like true events, it feels, like something, it feels like a two-dimensional thing rendered in three dimensions, and you wonder why the third dimension exists. And I definitely got that sense from some of the anecdotes too. It's like, okay, I really do feel like this came out of notes and has been rendered very faithfully, but isn't super interesting for like a novel. I did enjoy it, probably a little more than Hans, mostly for the bureaucracy. I thought the bureaucracy was fascinating. I'd love to talk about the bureaucracy a little bit. I think that the starting from early in the novel, is it the mayor who passes down like basically rules, saying we need searchers and we need examiners and we need chirurgeons and we need, and reading through that and kind of sort of intersecting a few, you know, of those role players, that's interesting to me, but it's not interesting for the reasons of, you know, like a novel would be interesting to me.
No, I think that there are comparisons to be made when we're talking about like enjoying it on the level of like an archaic text that tells you something about the time at which it comes from, and comparisons that come to mind are like the Eel essay in Waterland, the chapters on cetaceans in Moby Dick. I think things like that are pretty similar in terms of like getting kind of a clean look into some set of nonfiction information that's intriguing by itself. So I think that's going on in the book. I definitely agree that, like, you know, as a novel, it's certainly, it doesn't have many of the traditional elements, like an overarching central character or plot or narrative. You know, unlike the two other books by Defoe that I've read, Robinson Crusoe and Moll Flanders, both of those kind of have a central character with an arc, and you kind of care about what happens to them. This book doesn't seem to have that as much, but what I think is interesting or strange is that I swear we've read a ton of modern books on this podcast without, you know, central characters with narrative arcs that go nowhere and do nothing that both of you guys like. And I like too, you know. So I don't think that can be... I don't think that that specific form of a novel that doesn't do novelistic things should discount us or should discount this book from whatever. Obviously, you know, whatever your experience is when you read this is whatever your experience is. I don't necessarily think it should be a mark against it that it doesn't do the normal novelistic thing. I actually think that's something interesting that's going on here.
Stonehenge is interesting, but also boring as shit at the same time.
Sure.
Like, I'll qualify. I think, like, so another book that came to mind is books that sort of play with situating themselves in actual events that, and then doing a fictional treatment of them. So The Sotweed Factor, a book that we read in, for this podcast, right. But also 2666, actually came to mind.
I've never read that. By Bolaño, right?
Yeah, get ready. The relationship to real events is, there's a tension between that and the play that the writer is engaging in, mm-hmm. in order to kind of explore a space that they create by sort of by using that, like, those real events as a jumping off point, which is why it's so interesting to me that Defoe is alive for the plague, but I feel nothing of him in this, you know? So, and that's like, but I don't know Defoe. I actually have never read Robinson Crusoe or Moll Flanders. I just didn't know. I couldn't really put my finger on what was aesthetic in this and what was, right. you know, non-fictional. And it makes me wonder if it's just that this is such a proto example of this thing. But usually I think you're reading fictionalized true events for that sense of play with the past. And right. that sense of play is a lie that gets you to a greater truth. I don't know what that greater truth is in this instance.
I read a pretty, I don't want to like, I go guess I don't want to blow my load
splooge. Go for it.
Well, this has to do with question five, my last question. And the question I think is probably most important and why I ultimately think this is cool. Like, this is a cool work. This is something that I was feeling, but not necessarily, I didn't necessarily put it into the same words but I did some research. I read an article called Lies, Damned Lies and Statistics, Fiction and Epistemology in a Journal of the Plague Year. And the main thesis of that article that I read, and which I agree with, and which I think I understood kind of in a non-linguistic way, was that basically the blend of nonfiction and fiction is attempting to do two things. It's the statistics from the actual bills of mortality is attempting to give us real information. Not attempting, it is giving us real information about what really happened. But what's cool about the fictional aspects is that the fiction actually tells a lie to get to a deeper truth, which is that the actual reality of the plague isn't numbers and, you know, just tables of data on a page. It's actually people suffering and experiencing heartbreak and, you know, doing illogical things. And so for the two anecdotes that I mentioned in the introduction strike me as good examples of this. So like those really affected me. Like I was deeply emotionally involved with this river trader who is, you know, he's like, yeah, my wife and kids, they have the plague. They're going to die. And so I'm just going to slave my life away to make sure that they're comfortable until they pass. And that was devastating to me. I don't know what you got, what book you two robots are reading, you know, but I'm like, damn, that hurt. You know, like he knows his kids are going to die. He knows his wife's going to die, and this is what he can do. And then, you know, the two brothers who are like telling lies and like trying to finagle their way through the roads through town.
That was my favorite. John and Thomas.
Yeah, I think so. So basically what we're getting is this interesting use of nonfiction, but where the book is really telling the truth is in these fictional anecdotes where we actually feel like, oh shit, this sucks. This is horrifying. And I thought that was awesome. I thought, damn, that is an interesting form and really definitely for the time I think it's groundbreaking. So, you know, I guess that's my spiel. Like, that's why I think this book is really awesome and why it's worth reading. And I didn't, like, you know, Hans, you said, like, it's boring. It's both sad and boring. And I definitely didn't find it boring. I was mostly interested the whole time. So I don't know. I did want to point out, Chris, that you said, you know, you don't know, like, what is Defoe in this. And having read Robinson Crusoe and Moll Flanders, basically, I would say, like, the Christianity thing is definitely, like that's present in both Crusoe and Moll Flanders. Both of them are heavy, like, you know, Moll Flanders is the story of a woman who becomes a prostitute due to hard circumstances, but at the end, you know, she's brought back into the fold of Christianity and forgiven and lives a happy life or whatever. You know, and I do think that in Robinson Crusoe and in Moll Flanders, that Christianity thing is too much. Like it's too much of a morality play type thing. But I feel like in this book gets away with it a little better just because when you're like it openly gives us the contradiction of the time and the event, which is that the plague is both given by and taken away by God.
Mm-hmm.
Which I find to be you know, like that's just a logical contradiction that Christians have to deal with, you know, forever, you know. But the presence of that in this novel makes me feel like the novel is more complicated than the other two.
Yeah, it probably is one place where the difference between, you know, a totally fictionalized thing and a fictionalization of a real thing, you can kind of see the differences there in like what those allow an author to do, right? Like with, I haven't read Moll Flanders, but I mean, because that's a totally invented character, I believe, as I understand it, right? Like you have the option to you have the ability as a religious author to sculpt a narrative that kind of neatly bears out the idea that right. you have about how religion should work and influence the world. And with something like this, where you're basing what you do on an account of, as you noted, a numerically detailed account of a true event, you kind of have to account for the fundamental messiness of life, right? And how that just, and it is aesthetically honest of Defoe, probably to, in spite of his own convictions, to make something that still acknowledges the muddiness and complexity of the actual world as it occurs, and the ways in which, you know, nothing, the messiness of the world cannot be ultimately accounted for or mapped onto something as neat as monotheistic religion.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's kind of jumping off of that, the bureaucracy that I mentioned before is also sort of interlaced with the religiosity in a kind of complicated, interesting way.
Right.
That, you know, basically when a household is found to be sick, it's like shut up and people are kept inside. And I think I understood this correctly. Like the mayor's orders are for God have mercy on our souls. Written on the doors of every house that is, you know, sick.
Right.
And there's this interesting way in which that is functioning both as a, you know, an appeal to God, who you know, is the tormentor in this case, but also the savior, and also is functioning as a state, as something that is legible to the state. Right. So like you can see which houses are sick and which ones aren't, which ones people should not be leaving or going to and from. And so it is just really interesting how that, I think, complicates God's grace. It doesn't feel very graceful. And I think that that's just more satisfying for a modern reader, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. What else was I going to say? I was thinking, I also wanted to point out, you know, that bureaucracy is actually a thing in his other novels too. So that's another Defoe thing. Like in Robinson Crusoe, there's he keeps tallies of, you know, different, you know, the supplies he has, and when he and Friday kill a bunch of indigenous people, obviously that the book calls savages, you know, there's a list of, like, you know, I shot two or three people on Friday, killed eight or something. So there's definitely, like, and given that Robinson Crusoe is kind of a screed in favor of, like, the control of nature and, like, the capitalistic impulse, it seems like bureaucracy and you know, control of nature go hand in hand for Defoe. So,
I mean, just to go off of, you know, if we're talking about the bureaucracy, I'm not super, super, super unfamiliar with texts written during the early 1700s or, you know, about the mid 1600s. And so I'm not really familiar with the time, but I'm going to say I found the overall the book pretty boring, Patrick, but I was, interested just to see, you know, you mentioned capitalism, which, you know, I had a timer going. I can stop that timer now.
how long it would take me to mention?
Yeah.
Sure. How long did it take me?
I'm joking. I don't have a timer. But the, the way in which sort of the appointments of these roles, like there's guardsmen at the watchmen at the doors of these shut up houses. There's women who are supposed to kind of, I guess, be cannon fodder and go in and take care of, you know, sick people, or determine who is sick and who isn't. And they're not paid, right? Like, they're just basically told to do it, or they're going to be like arrested if they don't do it. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's in the mayor's orders. Like,
it's explicit.
It's explicit. Yeah. If they refuse, they get to, you know, rot in a jail cell.
Sure.
And then chirurgeons get paid. But it just was fascinating to me. You know, and then people are escaping, you know, they're using, they're distracting the watchman at their door and slipping out and getting away. And this tension just sort of is fascinating to me because it feels like it's telling me a lot more about how human beings are valued at this time, you know, where,
yeah, definitely,
life is a whole lot cheaper, like a whole lot cheaper, and juxtaposing it against now, and we say, and rightfully so, we criticize the way that capitalism commoditizes life, even in really the absence of like a free market, those lives are extraordinarily cheap. and so it's I don't know, it just gave me a different perspective on like how a state handles a public health crisis. Because it always is this thing where it's like, hey, we're doing this for your benefit, but really if we're doing it for anyone's benefit, we're doing it for the benefit of a statistical abstraction of a populace. And that's not to say public health is wrong. Public health is amazing, but it is always in tension with the individual rights of people. And now that's mediated, you know, very differently than how it's mediated in this book. There's just an incredible aloofness to this time between the state and its people that I find just really fascinating. And I wonder how anything like this sort of unfunded mandate of like, hey, make sure all this happens. And you know, it's your head if it doesn't happen. I wonder how that works, you know, like do people, I mean, obviously we read people, not adhering to the letter of the law or its intent and just kind of doing whatever the fuck they want. So like, it's just really interesting to me. That is, you know, the thing that I'm going to take away from this is in some cases, the more things change, the more they stay the same. But also, just what is it like for a state to manage a crisis in a capitalistic market driven society, when the currency is, sort of very unquestionable, state and, religious authority. So that's my spiel on this.
Yeah. That's definitely interesting. You know, we're kind of in the early stages of capitalism here, from my understanding. Like, historically speaking, capitalism emerges in the 1600s. And so what we've got here is, you know, largely a capitalist society, but the government hasn't fully evolved into, you know, a quote unquote representative democracy. It's still a monarchy with, you know, very strict top down a very strict hierarchical structure of authority. Not, you know, we're, you know, I say quote unquote representative democracy because we're, I personally don't think that what our government is a democracy, but, you know, in name it is. But it's still certainly more advanced than this, I would think.
Yeah, I'd say for sure.
Right.
Like this, sure. The monarchy in this is not, so far as I can tell through the mechanisms that they're applying, like I say the monarchy, but I really actually know so little about the time. So I'm just saying like state control. The state control seems to be largely, you know, the Chirurgeons get paid, but other than that, it seems like the, like, I don't know that there's a lot of control that's levied through capitalistic mechanisms.
Right. Yeah, I see what you're saying. That, yeah, like ruling by decree strikes me as more monarchical.
Yes.
Whereas ruling by, you know, you do this, I'll pay you this is more when capitalism and the government have merged like they have now, which we haven't quite gotten to here in this book. I definitely, you know, kind of let loose on my spiel. So maybe that's it for this discussion. Maybe we don't have more to say unless anybody else wants to, you know, say something interesting. Like we've gone far astray just to talk about like monarchy and capitalism and all that. So are there any other, is the comparison to The Last Man, is that an interesting question for you guys?
In some ways, I think it is. I mean, it's an interesting distinction because they're such completely different books,
yeah.
Even though they're both incredibly messy as novels, right?
Right.
They're like case studies in two utterly different ways to make something that is by standard novel rules pretty sloppily put together, you know. I mean, I think that like they're probably both ultimately of academic and historical interest more so than something you would read for the interest of the conventional, you know, gratification you would get from
Right. Yeah.
And I mean, I when I say that they're different, right? It's like this book has a quality of being a whole bunch of kind of little anecdotes and scenes that don't really cohere. And Last Man has this kind of monomaniacal fixation on one process, right? Of everybody just kind of randomly dying over of this plague over hundreds of pages in this very, you know, I don't know the metaphor for it exactly, right? But it's kind of like focused far beyond the point where that is a good thing. And I suppose they're both interesting in that they're both, if you the most, in my own experience at least, probably the most intriguing way to think about both of them is actually to kind of look in a craft and historical context at how they're assimilating and interpolating historical events, right? In this case, just kind of like a record of the time. In the case of Last Man, the ways in which the whole thing becomes an allegory for Shelley's sadness over the loss of her friends and her husband. And I think they're both interesting too in that they, you know, like for up until the 20th century, there's some fundamental level of inexplicability to a plague or to anything to do with disease and health.
Right.
Particularly to something like this, where this event sweeps in and destroys the population and sweeps out again. And on some level, you just don't know why, right? And both of those, I mean, if I remember right, I think in Last Man, there's sort of the vague idea that one of the characters has like summoned this up in some kind of like dying, his wife died in the siege of Constantinople, and he was so mad about it that he sort of like summoned up the plague through kind of an incantation or something, right? Or like he pissed off a witch. I don't remember now exactly. Right. It's oddly elliptical.
I don't remember
how it's
exactly
presented.
Either.
I think he might have pissed off a witch, but whatever. The point ultimately being that they're both, you know, a big part, I think, of both of those is dealing with the kind of arbitrariness and inexplicability, even in a very, very religious context of human mortality, really, in this particular setting, but just maybe generally, right? So I do think actually those two works speak to each other in very intriguing ways for like finding these kind of those underlying commonalities, despite in some ways being radically different as, you know, in structure.
Like they're radically different. Yeah.
They're radically different, and yet they're both, they end up being hung up on the same questions, in some ways use under the surface kind of versions of some of the same techniques.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, I kept wondering while I was reading this, you know, what would they have done if they knew that the plague was spread by fleas? Like, what would you have done? Like, I guess you just like, yeah, well, I guess we got to wash our clothes.
Well, fleas that jump off rats, right? So you'd want to avoid both fleas and rats. I mean, presumably they would have put enormous effort into eradicating rats. I don't know how much, to your point, it's true that I don't know how much you can really do with rats and fleas in the 1500s, but
right. And they did. The narrator does point out that they kill like thousands and thousands of dogs and cats. And you almost certainly don't want to kill either, because those are the predators of rats, right?
Yeah, that of course, by itself, yeah, a huge mistake.
Yeah. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I guess it's hard to do the counterfactual, right? Because if they knew that it came from fleas, what else do they know, right? What else do you understand in that context?
Right.
Yeah, they're avoiding the houses of the long dead because they don't understand that, you know, I believe I understand this correctly, like most pathogens die with the host, and, you know, after a couple days you can go in and clean up the house and you're fine. But like they really don't have any idea. So just kind of bouncing back to The Last Man. It strikes me, I mentioned before, I don't get a lot of, it just strikes me that if, to experience this when you're five is to not remember it, but to kind of have it be mythologized, I feel like.
Sure.
And this feels so absent of that mythology, of what it means to mostly have constructed memories of it. Like, you know, I feel like that age is just very just rich for like having hazy ideas of events that are sort of host to the stories that your family tells, and then it kind of grows. And I read it wrong. I know that this is maybe based on an ancestor's journal, but like it just feels very impersonal to me. Whereas The Last Man feels so kind of blindly personal and unedited that I feel like they kind of, what Hans was saying, like they commit almost opposite sins, but they do it in they end up,
well, this book doesn't commit any sins. Well, The Last Man does, but
I actually like The Last Man better than this book.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more interested in how
Last Man was just too long for me.
Oh, like, it was super just, long. Yeah.
Like it just needed, it needed to like be half as long.
Yeah.
And yeah, it could, sure. it you know, it would have been a little bit stronger.
Yeah. I guess this is good because it's short. I will say that right. This is, at least this is short.
I think like this is as long, this book, is succeeds in that. Like it keeps it. It's very direct, very straightforward. It kind of, there is some repetition. I think Hans, you said there's some repetition of not anecdotes, but like ideas and whatnot that gets said.
There's a repetition of stories that prove the same idea.
Right. Sure. But it, I think the length is strong for this one. Definitely in comparison to The Last Man. Go ahead.
Oh, the thing I was going to say takes us in a different direction. So we can come back to it. What were you going to say?
I think I was just going to say to Chris that I think that the kind of distance of the narrator is actually interesting in this. You said, Chris, that you found this very distant, whereas The Last Man is not. You know, it's blatantly personal, and I found the distance in this kind of intriguing. So I don't know. I don't have anything more to say necessarily about it, but so feel free to take us wherever you want, Hans.
Oh, I don't know if there's too much to add to what I was going to say, but I was just going to point out that we have read a third Plague novel that we haven't mentioned yet.
Oh, did what was that?
Eiffelheim.
Mm. Oh yeah, the best one of the three.
By far the best one of the three. Very
yeah,
good.
By yeah, yeah. far. Yeah,
I would agree. It's the best.
I mean,
it's kind
of hard to compare,
three.
Right? Because it's not
right.
It's you know, like we've been complaining about these things that are not written according to, well, I've been complaining, and you're not so bothered now, but we've been complaining about these things, both, you know, Last Man and Plague Year, I think, are both, feel incredibly unedited, probably partly because they were written at a time when, like, we just hadn't yet firmed up what right. are, like, the rules aesthetically for what a novel should do. A complaint right. we had about Bleak House, too, right? Whereas, you know, Eiffelheim had the advantage of being written both from a time of greater intellectual understanding of what the process of disease was, and also, you know, at a time when people, you know, the science of the novel had been refined. But I mean, I think, like, you know, one thing I was thinking when I was reading Plague Year is it would be incredibly difficult to write something that did have conventional novelistic values about a plague, because there's so little room. You know, the thing that is happening and the reasons for it and the reasons it begins and ends are so poorly understood, and there's so little that really can be done by anybody. And, right. and so many of the things that people think they're doing that are effectual here, whether medically, administratively, whatever, are in fact, we understand now, just, you know, puppetry, right? Empty theater. And so there's very little room for agency, decision-making, effect, right? And Eiffelheim, you know, has the advantage of enough understanding of the circumstances to construct a narrative in spite of that, right? Where it becomes kind of, right. I suppose, well, if I remember right, I guess you'd say Eiffelheim, like it's ultimately about like the finding grace within things that cannot be changed, right? The plague kills the people, and the fact of life on Earth kills the aliens, and they find grace and understanding in acceptance of that and in connection and love. And that's, I guess right. that is a story you could write about this, but I mean, it's, you know, pretty far from what Defoe intended to do.
Right, yeah. I'm glad you brought up Eiffelheim. Interestingly, I love Eiffelheim, and I remember that being my pick, and I just love that book so much. But even that novel needed editing. even that novel needed the scenes set in the present. I think we all came to the agreement that if they had just gotten, if the author had just gotten rid of those, the book would have been solid. I think we agreed with that. You guys.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I don't remember that opinion, but that sounds like something I would have thought.
Yeah. All right. I think I remember that too.
I think it's Iffelheim, and this is maybe true of Last Man actually too. I think both of those are books where in the moment of reading them, I had mixed feelings, but as time has passed, the things that I was moved by or that I admired have really kind of stuck in memory, and the critiques and annoyances have just kind of washed away with all the other sort of garbage of the mind, you know? So
yeah.
I'm looking through, I'm just Googled it. Like, it just strikes me that Plague, pandemics, they have such a profound psychological impact on us, on human society and the human experience. And I just don't, what is the great pandemic novel, the great plague novel?
The Stand.
No, that's what I was actually going to suggest. Yeah. I think that's it.
It's fun reading.
The first half of The Stand is incredible, like incredible. But I really do, and I'm going off of a list that I can't, you know, verify the veracity of, but there's, you know, Iffelheim's on here and a couple of other ones, but like, yeah, it's interesting to me that there isn't more in the canon that we hold up. And I wonder if it is because, as a subject, as a backdrop, either as a backdrop or as the subject of a novel, it just doesn't work generally. I don't know. It's just interesting to me.
Station 11.
I like
Station 11, but it's not. I really admire the writer, and I'm glad it exists, but it is not one of the great novels of history. I think that's
sure. And I haven't read the novel. I liked the show, but I can't speak to how the novel works as a novel.
I think the show is an example like Inherent Vice, where the show might have been an improvement on. And I actually think she was involved in the show and revised things.
The film Inherent Vice was worse.
I mean,
not to dig up old disagreements.
Yeah,
I think Patrick, you did talk me into having a higher opinion of the novel.
Oh, but excellent!
I have more opinion, more respect and more affection for the novel after the podcast. And also, if I had to choose right now to either watch the movie again or read the novel again, I'd probably watch the movie again. That might partly just be a question of what would take up less time, but.
Of what?
Inherent Vice.
Oh, okay. So that's what you were talking about, Inherent Vice? You think the novel's better?
Well, Chris was saying Station 11 and Inherent Vice are both things where the film/TV adaptation were successful.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That's,
But were you saying that your opinion of Plague Year got better after this discussion?
No, just Inherent Vice.
Oh. All right. That's fine. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure this isn't the, like, we've all disagreed before, and I assume we'll disagree again. I hope not.
It's so exhausting.
Oh, sorry. What can you do? Does that really bum you out when we
No,
when
no.
We all
I mean, I will say that,
things?
Like, I've learned, you learn certain things and you forget them, and you learn them and you forget them, right? And one of the things I've learned not to do is to bring the framework of, oh, fuck, I really loved this. I can't wait to talk about it with my friends. Because you often get your feelings hurt that way, right?
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. Like, I don't, I respect Plague Year and think it's super interesting, but I wouldn't say my feelings are strong enough about it to get hurt by this book. It's more like to get hurt by you guys not enjoying it. It's more like, I definitely think this is interesting, and I'm surprised they're not as interested as I am. But there are definitely books that, like, I could bring here, and if I was like, oh, it's so good, blah, 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 and if you guys were like, this sucks, I'd be like, shit, I don't have a heart anymore, you know? Yeah. All right. Anything else we want to mention Journal of the Plague Year or anything else that we've talked about? Like anything that you want to say that you didn't get to say?
I think I'm good.
Yeah, all right. I think I'm good too.
All right. Well, then it's Chris's pick for next time. What's the pick?
I mentioned 2666 earlier, and I was thinking about it. It is really long. So, and it's got multiple parts. So
Well, I think for Bleak House, we waited like 4 weeks. So we could just make it longer, or we could.
I did have another idea.
Break it up into different episodes, whatever you want
to
do.
I know you guys don't like to be given choices, but I also thought about Crash by Ballard.
Ballard.
J.G. Ballard.
Yeah.
I love the movie. I don't know if I've ever read the book. Like, I love that movie.
Yeah, the movie's great. And that one occurred to me because we've done a series of books and movies now, and I love both.
I was thinking, instead of picking this one, I was thinking of doing a movie-book combo, but then ultimately I picked Plague Year. But I'll probably do a movie-book combo next time, here in however many weeks, 6 weeks, when it's my pick again.
We can do Crash, unless, Hans, you want to do 2666. I would like to do 2666. It occurred to me, for whatever reason, that chapter, I don't remember if it's called The Crimes or whatever in 2666. The part about the crimes. Talk about a bleak motherfucking thing. That popped into my head while reading The Year of the Plague.
Is 2666 the book about is that about Juarez?
Yep, and the killings of women.
All the women who get killed and murdered, and so it's probably super depressing.
It is
my favorite kind of book.
Pretty fucking dark.
I don't care. Like, I'm fine either with Crash or 2666.
I would like to do 2666, but I think we would need to work something out because it has, like 900 pages, and it has big chunks that kind of like stand almost on their own.
Let's work it out right now. How do you want to do it?
I'll say, before we get too far into working it out, I can do whatever with 2666 because like I wrote my MA thesis was on this book. So I could probably talk.
You don't even need to read it again. Honestly,
I'm not trying to brag. I just do whatever you. If you want to do 2666, set it up however you need to, and I can cope because I'm pretty familiar with that book.
Okay. There's 5 parts.
There's 5 parts. I think if you wanted to split it down the middle, the first three and then the fourth and fifth maybe would be a good division.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to do 2 episodes, one on the first 3 parts, and then the next time on the last 2?
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine.
Unless you guys would prefer to do Crash and we save 2666. Because I was excited about Crash, actually, and then 2666 popped in my head again while reading The Plague Year. So...
Man, I'm entirely like they're both. I adore Ballard. I adore Cronenberg. I adore Crash. We have done Cronenberg recently. So
yeah, we did. It's true.
That might be a good reason to wait a bit.
Okay. Let's do 2666.
Okay. So in 2 weeks when we talk again, we'll talk about the first three parts.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then we'll take 2 more weeks to read the last part of the novel.
Yeah.
Right?
Last two parts.
And then it'll be Hans's pick.
Correct.
Yeah. I'm okay. Down. This is one of the most powerful things I've ever read. So I'm happy to dive back
in. Well, I hope I like it. I don't know if I will.
You're kind of setting us up for a hard conversation.
I know Hans is already like Hans already converted me to it. So it's really up to Patrick, but I have a feeling you're going to like it, Patrick.
I hope so. I admit to having never tried out Bolaño because he always struck me as like in the same vein as like these postmodern authors that you guys like that I tend to not like. So I don't know. But we'll see. I mean,
the objections you'd have to, you know, like, I don't know, William Gass, right? Like this is very, very different from a Gass novel. Okay. Or like, I mean, it's, I guess you could maybe like, well, we can talk
well,
about
well, that, right? Compare like, I was going to say, like, you could the
maybe, there's some
arguably
DeLillo-esque things about how he like works with theme maybe, but even that, we can talk about it.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, listeners, that you probably have checked out like when we started talking about things besides A Plague Year, like 5 minutes in to the podcast. But if you're still here, sorry you had to listen to all the logistics. So next time we're going to talk about the first 60-ish% of 2666 by Roberto Bolaño. So I hope you come back and listen for the next episode. Peace.